Talk given Sunday, 11th May, 1975. The fulfillment of man is the realization of transcendence, which means that transcendence comes to full fruition through man, as man in the image of God. We talked about this at the last group weekend in March. Through the ages, great teachers have made their own affirmation of transcendence and of man's fruition and what it means. India has talked of it as moksha, liberation, as realizing the Atma, becoming one with Brahman. That was their terminology. The Buddha spoke of nirvana, of deathlessness. Jesus spoke in terms of the kingdom of heaven. Zarathustra presented it as the realization of Garodemana, the life eternal in the house of songs, Garodemana. Islam presents it as paradise, Behesta, and so on. In our day and age, we use a slightly different language for the very simple reason that as the centuries go on, a new formulation comes into being. And at that weekend in March, we tried to see it in modern factual and psychological terms. You remember, I tried to suggest what the condition of supreme communion means in actual fact. And the supreme communion state is the state where man has come to full fruition and lives as the perfected man all day and every day of his life. That in this state, through each and every one of our senses, transcendence sees, hears, touches its own infinity in every finite object and person. Through your eyes, transcendence sees any particular thing, meets any particular person, and sees its own infinity in that particular thing or person. Sees its own immortality through the mortal, its own absoluteness through the relative, its own eternity through time. But that is not the whole story. You, the person through whom transcendence comes to full fruition in human terms, also see every object and every person in a totally different way. Different because you have become free of all conditioning. Therefore, you are free of all interpretation of the thing or the person you see in a distorted manner. You see the thing or the person with the perfect seeing possible to the perfect man. So you see what has happened, or rather what the implication of that is. There is no longer any selfness. In you yourself, the perfected one, as you see an object or a person. Which means that there is no reaction of grasping, of greed, of lust, of violence, of annoyance, of illusion, of fear. None of these things are there. You see completely factually, completely truly, because you as the separate self are no longer interfering with the process of seeing as you look at that object or person. There is nothing within you which interferes with that seeing. And that seeing is a transcendent seeing by you, the person. Whereas transcendence itself will see infinity and immortality and eternity and so on. Through your eyes, you will see at the same time that thing or person in perfection, the perfection possible to man utterly purified, with a mind that is empty of all illusion and delusion, of all defilements, and therefore is wholly transparent to the light of truth of transcendence. Similarly, you, the person, will hear everything in that way. You will touch everything in that way. So, at last, the physical senses have become, I'm going to use my old phrase, the cords of communion in the total and the supreme sense. I don't think this has been stated in such terms before. You will also see an object or a person in the manner which you saw objects and persons in the imperfect state, out of which you have grown into this transcendent condition. You will not forget that. You will not forget the imperfect, the sorrowful state. the state of delusion and illusion. If you forgot it, if you forget it, you will lose your touch with mankind, with things. Because that is how I, the ordinary man, see. And if the perfected Holy One has completely forgotten that, then how is he going to be able to touch me? He has gone away into Paranibbana, beyond Nirvana. This is a statement which has occurred in some of the Indian texts, and no one has ever explained how or why. But this is how or why. If I do not drink of the cup of sorrow to the dregs, the sorrow of mankind, if I do not touch the man who is unclean, how can I make a link with him, be a blessing to him? Therefore, I must not forget that. But because I can see that quite clearly and keep my touch, and because I can also see the embodied divinity in that particular person and the unique form and shape which belongs to that embodied divinity in that particular person, therefore, I can be in total and complete communion with him. Now have you understood something of the nature of supreme communion here and now and what it implies? Otherwise, it's all words and airy-fairy words. The sort of idealistic talk against which the practical man of the world naturally, not unjustifiably, rebels. But understand it this way, and no one can rebel against this. The perfected Holy One is not apart from the world in which he lives. He doesn't outlaw himself, outcast himself from the cosmos. He's completely at one with the cosmos. So for him there is no problem of either acceptance or rejection. In the total oneness, which has become a matter-of-fact, natural, spontaneous reality in his mind and consciousness, there is no conflict of any sort. There is nothing to accept, there is nothing to reject. He sees the good as the good, the bad as the bad, within the sphere of ambivalence. And he also sees and knows that which lies beyond, which transcends this, and in which this ambivalence is wholly subsumed. And because it is wholly subsumed, he can completely transmute everything. That is why the presence, the mere presence of the Holy One on earth is a benediction. You see, this transcendent perfection and beauty of religious fulfillment is an extraordinary fact. It is not an ideal dream. It is not the escape of the weak-minded or the not clear-sighted from the problems of life which they cannot face. It is the fact. This is man's destiny. This is your divine destiny individually. Please understand carefully what I mean when I say it is your destiny. Don't make it a fixed idea and say, right, I will strive for this. And obviously, because it is my destiny, if I can't fulfill it in this life, I shall come again in another life and again till I fulfill it. That is a nonsensical way of understanding it. Your destiny means that that which is the destiny of the whole human species can come to fruition through any particular individual. Here, there. If the particular individual is unable to manifest the fulfillment of that divine destiny through him, this great power of transcendence plus nature will slowly but surely bring it to fulfillment somewhere. Through the ages, there have been the perfected holy ones. They exist today, and they will always come into being. It is not for every leaf of the tree or every cell in the tree to be the flower or the fruit. But through the whole tree, there come flowers and fruits. Not for the whole tree, every one of those trees, to be the manifestation of the perfect flowering. We play our part, an indispensable part. So your destiny means just that, as far as the fruition is concerned. But as far as your particular pattern of life process is concerned, that is uniquely your destiny and will come out and manifest itself in some form or other, to some extent or other, through your life. Be content. Do not rail against God or fate or circumstance or the other person. Do the best possible. That will be your inner unshakable happiness. And in that state of inner unshakable happiness, it becomes possible for you to realize that other aspect, unshakable freedom of mind also. And if you realize that much, or if transcendence and nature bring you to complete fruition as man, then what happens? Because you are beyond acceptance, rejection, beyond condemnation, praise, approval, disapproval. You are beyond all that. What happens? Then, for anything and everything, for any and every situation, for any and every person, there will be only compassion. This is the Mahakaruna of the Buddha. There will only be pure wisdom in relation to the thing, the person, the situation. This is the Mahakaruna in transcendence. Because transcendence itself will manifest these things through you in the cosmic sense, in the infinite sense, and you yourself in the personal sense will manifest the same. You see the richness of this fulfillment, the marvel and the wonder of it. If you can glimpse this at all, quietly, with utmost sensitivity, you become a changed person. This wonderful thing called the metanoia, the conversion, the utter transformation takes place. You know how through the world's history there is record after record of those who underwent this metanoia. Not the conversion of the thousands who merely are moved emotionally and or intellectually and accept a form of belief. That is a step, if you like. But that is not the real metanoia. This real conversion is not a change after the fashion of rearranging the same old furniture in the same old room, but it is a complete transmutation of your whole being. Even the very cells of your brain, perhaps your body, are transmuted in some way or other. Might this be one of the deep meanings hidden in the word resurrection of the body? It is originally a Zarathustrian teaching, and it was taken over into Christianity. This transmutation of the body is the resurrection of the body. Not that what is in the coffin, if buried, or in the crematorium, the ashes which are scattered for the benefit of the plants and the flowers afterwards, not that that will ever rise up again. No, it is this.
What is it transmuted into?
I'll tell you afterwards. So you see, something of the significance and the implications of the state of supreme communion, of being constantly in the state of supreme communion, which is the ultimate fruition of man on this globe. Naturally, after trying to present this at the end of March last month, we went into certain aspects in relation to this. We asked ourselves the question, if we have had any glimmer of this at all, we who attend meetings and join societies and so forth and go on year after year, if this has become a reality for us and changed us in that direction towards this fruition, then have we grown in good sense? Have we grown in being quiet and silent? We must answer those questions for ourselves. Don't answer immediately, yes, no. Because these questions have to be answered all through our lives. It is not like passing an examination and getting a certificate and a degree and that's finished with. Have I grown quiet and silent? But this is part of my daily living process, and therefore every day, every moment of the day, I have to answer, am I quiet, am I silent? And what is one of the fundamental practical meanings of being quiet and silent, apart from the obvious dictionary meanings of stopping our endless, useless chatter? When that is, as far as speaking aloud is concerned, and being able to be silent in the mind itself, so that that stream of talk which goes through the brain is not a cacophonous babble all the time. What is one of its implications? What is one of the great implications of being quiet and silent? Are we not all marked by egoism? By a strong sense of I am I? And does it not express itself as imposing oneself upon one's situation? Of trying to dominate others, of always finding fault with others, and so on and so on. This imposition of oneself upon the world in which we live, as the Buddha called it, self-obtrusiveness. When self-obtrusiveness has vanished, I am silent. The perfected holy ones were utterly free of all self-obtrusiveness. But they weren't silent in the sense of never opening their mouths and speaking, or never using their senses and thinking carefully. All that went on. But they did not obtrude self upon the world. Remember that marvelous statement of the Buddha amongst the thousands of marvelous statements that he made. He who is free of all self-obtrusiveness may rightly, that is to say, legitimately, speak the word of truth. He used the term Brahmavada, the God word, the divine word. He may rightly speak that, if self-obtrusiveness is out. If we have understood anything at all through the years, with the practice of our meditations and devotions and whatnot, have we become cleansed of self-obtrusiveness? This is a question we must ask. And if self-obtrusiveness moves out, with it goes vanity. Ego and vanity go together. Physical vanity, to be pretty, to be attractive, to be beautiful, to be strong, to be a great athlete, to have mighty prowess, intellectual activity. We are clever people, capable people, intelligent people, bright people. Listen to all the tittle-tattle of the bright people when they meet in their clubs or their little social groups and so forth. The quiet person is the spiritual genius. Quiet outwardly, quiet inwardly, particularly quiet inwardly. So we must ask these questions of ourselves. And we must go on to ask, and this we shall add today, have we learned something at least of the art of right mindfulness? Everybody in the world is mindful in some way or other. You and I and everybody in the world is mindful. But is it right mindfulness? Is it perfect mindfulness? What do you think the Buddha meant by the term sammāsati? Translated both ways, right or perfect. I always prefer to use the word perfect here. Perfect mindfulness. What do you think the Buddha meant by that? Consider why and how we attempt to be mindful, why we practice it. In order that I may move on the path and become the arahant, find nirvana, the blessedness of nirvana. But this is the very negation of the path, the very negation of nirvana, the utter negation of the fact of fulfillment. It is not I who come to fulfillment. In the deepest states of consciousness, going through the jhanas, for instance, and the samapattis. Look at the third volume of the Majjhima Nikaya and you will see it there. The Buddha is talking of Sariputta going through this. And he says that Sariputta is not aware in terms of I am entering this state, I am coming out of this state. There is no I present. This is right mindfulness. Our mindfulness is wholly self-oriented. It's a terrible indictment, if you like. And you will say, have I evidence? I don't need the evidence. You look into it yourself, for yourself. Why should I produce the evidence for you, even if I could? Because if I produce the evidence, your mind will rise up against it in opposition. You'll be angered. You'll be offended. You look into yourself and see, am I rightly mindful? Am I doing it for my sake? Or because this is the way which expresses the true meaning of human living. You see? Mindfulness. Am I rightly mindful? Unself-consciously mindful. You see how all these things are linked up? Ego, vanity, mindfulness. Everything, every one thing is linked up with everything else. And if one is mindful in the right way, you will notice that relinquishment and renunciation, virtues supremely extolled by all the great teachers, become second nature to us. We don't have to make an effort to renounce this, that or the other, or relinquish this, that or the other. Because non-grasping has become natural to us. We don't grasp at anything. We don't desire anything. And under those circumstances, there is no inner psychological conflict. There is peace. This is the nirvanic mode of the functioning of the mind and the heart. Whatsoever is really necessary is attended to perfectly. And whatsoever is unessential for the fruition, not of me, the separate self, but the fruition of the great process by which mankind comes to realization, whatsoever is unnecessary for that falls off by itself. See how the Buddha emphasized non-grasping. And this is deathlessness, speaking to Ananda. Namely, the cessation of all grasping, particularly including, grasping at nirvana. You cannot catch hold of transcendence. At least a century before the Buddha, Yajnavalkya of Upanishadic fame says of the Atma, it is unseizable. The transcendent is unseizable. It cannot be seized. It does not tremble. There is no fear present there. And the Buddha, you'll find it in the third volume of the Long Discourses, talking about the Arahant, the worthy one, the perfected one, says that he is one who is incapable of embarking upon a course of action through fear. That's one of the nine things that he says about the Arahant. So you see how all these things fit into the living reality of perfection, which can come to manifestation on this planet only through you, the individual, through you, the person, the man, the woman. Is there anything airy-fairy about this? The airy-fairy things don't need hard work. This needs blood, tears, toil, sweat, as nothing else in human life does. You will see then another extraordinary consequence of realizing the implications of the vision of transcendence. Problems are always present in life. The perfected holy ones all had problems, and those problems were continuously presented to them by circumstance, by people. But none of the holy ones said, "Oh dear, this is my problem now." There is no such thing as my problem. When you see and understand the truth of self, when there is the condition of non-isolative self-consciousness, no problem becomes self-oriented. How well do you study the discourses? And if you study them well, you notice this phrase occurring time and again. The Buddha says, "He is one who has laid down the burden." What a wonderful phrase. He who carries the woe of the world on his shoulders, or rather, he who has embraced the world woe right in his own heart, has laid down the burden. Not my problem. The problem is there, yes. Let us see what can be done about it. If I say it is my problem, then I say it because I am forgetting that in making such a statement, the implication is that I don't understand myself or what I am. Hence, it is my problem in that isolative sense. And so, I heap up an unnecessary burden of sorrow upon myself, to start with, and I keep on making a mess trying to solve the problem. Neither you nor I can ever solve any problems which are our personal problems. In this deep sense, that one is isolatively, self-consciously tied up with the problem. Just see the fact. Here is a problem. Supposing the house catches fire, this house. All right, it is a problem. But if I make it, if I am conscious in terms that this is my problem, then the end result will always be bondage. If it is not my problem, then this person who is talking will do the best possible under the circumstance, and that's the end of the problematical aspect of the fact that the house caught fire. You see, if you do understand this, you will find the poison of all the hurt that inevitably comes to you in your life disappear. If you understand this, you will be free of making mistakes in human relationships. take one of the simplest difficulties. The difficulty is tremendous. I'm saying simplest because it is so universal, particularly in our day and age, of human relationships which involve love, as people call it, between man and woman. And to a lesser degree, perhaps, between man and man, woman and woman. See how these problems arise. See how these disruptions of a true and a right relationship arise. They arise out of desire, out of grasping, wanting satisfaction this way, laying down conditional reciprocity. I will be good if you are good. What price my goodness then? If the other person does something evil, am I going to do a greater evil? Out-devil him or her in devilry? You see what an absurd situation it is? One is dissatisfied here with this relationship, or someone else comes along, and lo and behold, there is an attraction, and one gives way to it. If I'm incapable of fulfilling my duties and responsibilities, which I myself have undertaken with respect to A, is there any likelihood that I will be more capable with B or C or D? Isn't that what the world does? We two can't get along. Off I go, find my soulmate. My dear people, each one of us could easily find 1,000 soulmates if we just traveled a bit over the world. If I make a mess with one soulmate, then in the first place, I have mistaken who was my soulmate. If she or he was my soulmate, there could be no mistake. There could be no disruption. I've made a silly fool of myself all along the way. But that I don't see. No, I was such a good chap. I am such a good chap. It's she who is all wrong, or it's all his fault. He's the fellow at the back of it. I didn't do anything. He ran away from me. She went off with that man. All right, she went off with that man. But if I have compassion and understanding, yes, I see the fact, and seeing the fact, there can only be right action and right relations from me under that circumstance. You may say, quite justifiably say, you're taking no account of human nature and emotional hurt. I'm taking full account of it. How does emotional hurt arise? Because there's self involved, selfness, which asks for this, that, and the other for oneself. It is natural, granted. I have said so right from the beginning, when I said that this living organism is descended from an animal ancestor. And the law of the animal is to draw the world unto itself for its self-preservation and the preservation of the species. But this particular animal organism, in the course of natural evolution, changed its structure and its functioning. And in the changing of that structure and functioning, something new which had lain dormant in animal organisms began to come into being. Mind. The freeing from ambivalence, the realizing of transcendence, the coming into being of a more marvelous integration not known on the planet before. So you see, the conflict arose. The law of the spirit seemed in opposition to the law of the jungle, the law of the animal. This conflict arose in man. This is our personal responsibility. Yes, of course, we've got to face it. So I'm not discounting the human emotional element at all. When we are young, we all go through these things. I'm not talking through my hat. I know a little bit about it. But one has to grow out of the old in order that the new may be present. Supposing a tree did not shed its leaves when the winter comes, or let its buds unfold into perfect flowers and the flowers wither away and so forth in their due time. Oh, you'll see the same old tree and the same old flowers stuck in there, you know. Just as if it were made of plastic. What would happen to the beauty and the marvel of life? Do we want to be dead dogs? Or do we want to be live human beings? And if we can't let go, if we can't cease from grasping, the magical joy of fresh creation would be totally denied us. So you see, one has to look deeply into all these things. We cling to our own sorrows. We don't let them go. Do try and understand this. This is one of the great causes, one of the very powerful sources of continual suffering when that suffering need not be there. You have to see for yourself, and in the actual seeing, get free of all possessiveness, of all grasping, of all clinging. Which means also hoping for this, expecting that, and so forth. Let all that go. See the truth of things as they are. And let life work its way through. Now, if the vision of transcendence has in any way really affected us, touched us, are these things true of us? We must ask ourselves the question. If and as they become true of us, then we are indeed living the religious life. Then indeed we are social beings. I said yesterday when the group was here that the modern shibboleth is the word socialism. Man just jumps out of one muck heap into another muck heap. He goes on doing this endlessly and with boring repetitiousness. The modern shibboleth is socialism. I would love to meet the man who can tell me what is the meaning of a social being. Who is the social being? I'll tell you what I mean by it. The man who's free of the curse of isolative self-consciousness, of self-centeredness. When I am free of all isolated self-consciousness, that root evil that you are you and I am I, two separate creatures, is out. If I am free of self-consciousness, then no longer it is a case of I am I, but I am integral part and parcel of all mankind, inextricably interwoven with the whole human race. Now if that mind and consciousness is second nature and natural to me, I am a social being. All society is included in my awareness then. Supposing we all were like that, how easy to cooperate. How easy to be social, to be sociable. What is sociability today? Oh, let's have a drink together and smoke 20 cigarettes in 5 minutes and live as idiotically as possible and say, we are being so sociable, you see. It is so unsociable not to talk when you're with others. You really must keep up a bright chatter and all the rest of the... Oh, my God. God save not only the king, but all his subjects also. And the queen. Yes, yes. You see? So, if we are like that, free of this curse of isolated self-consciousness and this almost irrefragable self-centeredness, if we are free of that, then the word social, socialism, sociability, all will have a pure, real life and true meaning. Then we'll have a happy society. Now, examine the whole of socialism of any brand, all the 57 varieties, after the Heinz's food products, 57 varieties business, examine the whole lot of them. And if you understand this is a basic principle, they will all go into the dust cart. Useless rubbish. Only excuses for man's greed, his egoism, his violence, his oppressiveness, his devilry. And the same applies to any other sort of political or economic or other ism, which is based upon separative self-consciousness. Which means the denial of transcendence. God, stand outside. Don't come and interfere with my affairs. This is how man lives. This is how we live. We must see into this. And then we shall be religious. And that will be a power of benediction over the whole world in which we live.